The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good afternoon. How are we feeling? Excited? Yeah. Awesome. For those of you who may not know me, my name is Omar Tate. I'm co-founder of Honeysuckle Projects. Honeysuckle Projects is an entity, my wife and I, Sybil, she's right here in the front row. we own that company. We use that company as a means to explore Black culture through food, literature, and art in several different facets. We're currently opening a store called Honeysuckle Provisions in West Philadelphia, 48th and Spruce. That is my that's my plug for today. Over the past 10 years, we've seen a new way of perceiving Black chefs. Chefs of color in this country have been becoming more prominent in the news, in media, in restaurants, restaurateurship. But now we're in 2022, and it's not just about chefs. It's about the entirety of culture. Today we have two writers that I really, really respect. They're both friends. They're also mentors, peers, whatnot. Brian Terry is the author of Black Food. I have a recipe in that book called Vegetarian Gumbo. There's a funny story about that that I wrote in the book, because there's really no such thing as vegetarian gumbo. But I was really, really, really excited to write that, because Black Food, this book, is the ushering in of a new vanguard to me, a way to really display and articulate all the artistic values and cultural values that create Black food. There is no Black food without Black people. So it's just a very, very important work that is not, it's not a definitive, it's a new beginning. The word that I like to think of is fecundity. You know, it's a fertile 300-page book that's ushering in everything yet to come. So without further ado, I will introduce Jamila Robinson, is the assisting managing editor for Food at the Philadelphia Inquirer, USA East Academy chair for the world's 50 best restaurants, and the journalism chair of the James Beard Awards. Among the most influential people in food media, Jamila is frequently sought out as a thought leader and contributor to publications and culinary organizations worldwide. Brian Terry is a James Beard and NAACP Image Award-winning chef, educator, and author, renowned for his activism to create a healthy, just, and sustainable food system. He is the founder and editor-in-chief of Four Color Books, an imprint of Penguin Random House and 10 Speed Press, and he is co-principal and innovation director of ZenMe, a creative studio he founded. His sixth book, a collection of recipes, art, and stories entitled Black Food, was published by Four Color Books, 10 Speed Press, in October 2021 to critical acclaim. Without further ado, Jamila and Brian Terry.
Good afternoon. I'm so happy to see you. I'm Jamila Robinson, and I'm so thrilled to be sitting here with my colleague, Brian Terry, to talk about this really beautiful force of literature and culture, Black food. I don't know if you want to say a few words, because I'm still fangirling a little bit, because whenever I get to talk to Brian, it's so special and joyful.
I do want to say a few words. I want to say it's such an honor to be sitting with you. Jamila is one of the smartest and one of my favorite food journalists. And when my book prior to this, Vegetable Kingdom, was released, I had the privilege of being in conversation with Jamila in D.C. We did an event sponsored by the Dying Diaspora Collective, and so it's great to bring this back full circle.
Oh, we're coming back full circle. Yeah. And that was just before the pandemic.
Oh, yeah.
And it was the one of the last events that I got to do. So to have that memory, this really strong memory of this really wonderful conversation of talking about our people, our culture, our history, and our food was such a joy. So I'm thrilled to be here sitting with you. I'm thrilled to be here with all of you. Thank you, Free Library, for having us.
Yeah, thanks for that reminder. You know, it's true. It's just like we got all revved up in that tour and then everything just shut down.
Yeah, it happens. It happens so fast, but we had Vegetable Kingdom to keep us sustained over the course of the pandemic. It was a quick pivot to kind of start talking about recipes and sort of think about, well, who are your favorite authors? Who are your favorite recipes? Well, here are some things that, some books that you should bring into your canon and into your cookbook to help you survive the pandemic. So, so I'm hoping that people really saw the beauty that you are bringing to the cookbook world with Vegetable Kingdom. It remains one of my favorite books. If you don't have it, that's a good book to go and pick up. But also, this one.
But, you know, I just want to say, you know, I was just deathly afraid that that book was going to disappear given like the pandemic and just people had a lot of other things on their mind at that time. So, you know, I do appreciate the fact that a lot of people really sank into a deeper cooking practice. And the book went on to do well commercially and critically. It was one of the best, most critically acclaimed
books.
One of the best books of the year.
Any stretch. It was one of our best books of the year, the Philadelphia Inquirer. Nationally, people talk about you and talk about how wonderful it is. And then even, you know, Vegetable Kingdom is a plant-forward book. I mean, and arguably Black Food is also a plant-forward book, but it gave us a different relationship with vegetables and understanding our relationship as Black people with the earth and with farming and with vegetables and how that is so important, which I guess is a good segue to kind of dive into Black food. You start in the book and you kind of talk about what Black food is, and you walk through so many different parts of culture, that Black food is people, Black food is recipes, Black food is conversation, Black food is LGBTQ. Can you talk a little bit about the process of putting this together? I love what Omar said. Thank you for that introduction, by the way.
I just realized
I forgot to do that. Thank you, Omar, for everything that you do and for that beautiful introduction. I love what Omar said about it being the vanguard.
Yeah.
How did you put a team together to bring the new vanguard of Black food?
Well, first of all, I want to say I could listen to and read Omar's writing all day, every day. The brother is brilliant, and I'm so honored that he was a part of this book and just feel so honored to be in community with you. And you inspire me to keep pushing my work forward. And I'll say that, you know, I told Jamila, and we could talk about this, just kind of this move into the art world that I'm moving into this year. And you really inspired that in so many ways. So I just want to big you up, brother, because you are the vanguard.
I just wanna...
For real. No exaggeration. In order for me to talk about this book, I have to first go back and talk about this position that I've had since 2015 as chef in residence at the Museum of the African Diaspora in San Francisco. And in 2014, Linda Harrison, the former executive director of the museum, approached me because I actually was artist in residence at Grace Cathedral, which is the seat of the Episcopal Church in California. So they had an artist in residence program. I think Anna DeVere Smith was the first one. This woman, Ann Taylor, this visual artist, was the second. And they invited me to be the third artist in resident. And that year, as a faith community, they focused on food, health, environmental issues, all the things that I've been focusing on. So they gave me the opportunity to create programming, both for the faith community and the wider public. And Linda Harrison was a member of the church, and she saw this, and it really just sparked this excitement about seeing MOAD, which is a fine art museum, as more than a fine art museum, more as this kind of elitist space that's catering to the needs of the bourgeoisie of the Bay Area. And she really understood that in a city like San Francisco that's suffering, that's really been dealing with massive out-migration of Black people for past three decades. Just to give people some, I'm sure some of you've heard about it over here, but you know, maybe like two decades ago, the percentage of Black folks in San Francisco was around 16%, and now it's about 3%. And this is because of gentrification, the tech industry, the exorbitant housing costs. So the museum is a real important space because it's a dwindling population of Black folks. And she wanted to see it as a refuge, as a safe space, as a space where people can come and learn and build community. And so she brought me on so we can co-create this program. And I started creating program. The first event I did was very intentionally Black Women, Food and Power, mm-hmm. in 2015. And it was a panel discussion in which I brought together these brilliant Black women, some scholars, some farmers, activists, poets. And I knew that we were onto something. You know, the fact that we had people flying out from the East Coast to come to a two-hour program in our small but mighty museum, I was like, wow, there's literally a, pun intended, hunger for this type of programming. And so, you know, this is 2015. Yeah. We didn't have the infrastructure for virtual programming. That's right. And so it's kind of like everything was held in a moment in time. And I think we liked it like that. You know, if you come to the museum, you can experience it. And if not, you come back to the next program. And but I had always had this desire to somehow capture the programming and share it with the world, and felt like a book could be a good way to do that. And so fast forward to 2020, where we as a country were having this racial reckoning and post-state murders of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd. And I knew this was the moment. I was like, this is the time where this book needs to come out, because it wasn't just that. It was also the revelation of a lot of racism in food media.
That's right. Right? That's right. I mean, that was... you know, the world was having its reckoning, the country was having its reckoning, but within our world, mm-hmm. at Bon Appetit, at the LA Times.
I wasn't going to say any names, but
I'm willing to name names. I mean, even at the Philadelphia Inquirer, we had our own issues of, you know, our headlines and things that are harmful to our communities. And so within food media, there was this realization. I mean, we had always known it. Food media is 92% white. I'm one of the only Black editors in the country, mm-hmm. and of which there are three. Tony Tipton Martin at Cook's Country is the other one, and Don Davis mm-hmm. at Bon Appetit, who's the new editor of Bon Appetit, is the other one. We are the only ones. Yep. And so this realization that there's this harm that's being done to our history, our culture, and our recipes was happening at that moment.
Yeah, and people. Mm-hmm. You know, I have a good friend who is an author. Well, she was an author, Clarkson Potter. And it came out that she was treated horribly. Like, just, I couldn't believe the way in which this publisher who invested money into a book project, you know, virtually tried to erase her.
No, they did erase her.
Yeah.
They erased her from their own work, which happens to a lot of us. We get erased out of our own history and our own stories.
Yep. And we could talk about this documentation, I think, you know, just thinking about cookbooks as primary sources for mm-hmm. future generations. But, you know, it was just a moment where I was very clear that I needed to use my power and platform position to do something. And my literary agent and I pitched this book. You know, I like to say my publisher, like, they enthusiastically jumped on it, and I love my publisher. Big up to them. This is no shade, but they kind of didn't have any other choice. You know, I don't know. If they didn't, it would have been a bad look given just the kind of reputational harm that a lot of the other food media institutions were confronting. And so, and when you look in the book, just to make that connection with the residency in Moat, like, literally, many of the chapters are pulled from programming that we did at the museum. The Black Women Food and Power, the Black Queer Food, Land Liberation and Food Justice. We did these real life programs where we brought people together to dig deeply into these issues. And so there was that kind of nugget, that inspiration there. And I just want to say that this was an opportunity for me to use my power in this moment to model the way that things could be done differently. So one of the first things that I made it very clear is that I want to have an all a mostly Black, if not all Black, creative team. If you all aren't aware that these so-called below-the-line jobs in food media, like, you know, food stylists and prop styling and even food photographers, these are largely, you know, white fields. I mean, there are very few people of color in them. That's changing a little bit, but historically, that's just been the reality. You know, you don't go to art school and major in food photography. You learn it from modeling, shadowing food photographers on set.
You learn it from being with shadowing chefs, mm-hmm. or being interested in food in some way, or sort of serendipitously falling into it, and then you end up with books by Black authors, or they're doing demonstrations and all the hands are white. And so there's this disconnect that happens with the book, mm-hmm. because of those positions that aren't there. So when you decide that, you know, not only do you want to convene people from, you know, from your conference, but you're also going to convene people in new roles and opening up these doors. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's a really beautiful way to use your platform.
And I'm glad you mentioned just the hands. You know, even when we were, you know, conceiving of the visuals for the book, we were very clear that we wanted Black bodies, we wanted Black hands, we wanted like just that kind of lifestyle feel where you saw that, you saw Black people just living their lives. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we could have even gone deeper, but you know, we had whatever, space issues. And then, you know, the art director. We have a brilliant art director at 10 Speed Press, and I don't know if they ever bring in outside art directors, but I let them know that for this book project, it's important that we have a Black art director, and not just a Black, any Black art director, but a Black art director who understands Black aesthetics, Black visual language, Black history, and who could connect with this work in a spiritual way. And so going into this process, we were very clear that as a team, the outcome was important, but the process of putting this book together was equally important. And we were very intentional about this. And I never came into a book, Jamila, with this level of intentionality and care. Over book. And just so you all know, I was telling Jamila, she didn't even know this. We put this book together in 9 months.
He had a whole pandemic baby.
Yeah, this is like, because I was jokingly calling him that. And then my friend who's a doula, she said, you know, this the gestation period. That really is your baby. And I'm like, yeah, this is my pandemic baby.
And that's fascinating because it usually takes 2 to 3 years to write a book or to produce a book. In 9 months, you were able to convene this team, have a whole new creative process put together, and then get all of these people. You get Omar Tate, Osai Endolin, Zoe Ingenieur, and these are, I'm calling out really important Black food writers, luminaries, chefs, who are really changing how we think about food and how we think about the diaspora. Black food is a diaspora. Mm-hmm. And you were able to get all of those people on board to help bring this to life.
And honestly, I am sometimes still amazed that we were able to get all these brilliant people in this book because, you know, the reality is we were in this moment where a lot of these institutions were embarrassed. Mm-hmm. They were very intent on repairing reputational harm. And so black folks were hot. A lot of Black food creators were getting a lot of work during that period. And I just like, you know, I don't expect that everyone will be free. But, you know, there was a period, Jamila, over 3 months, well, probably like 2 months, where I was having conversations every single day, like 8 to 10 conversations with people around the world, Zooms, calls. And you know, some people within the first couple of minutes, like, I'm good, count me in. But some people really just wanted to hear the vision. And I was like giving this, like, just explicating like this vision of what this book will be, because I really wanted people to like feel like a deep connection and commitment to what we were trying to do. And you know, I feel so blessed because obviously, you know, I am the convener of this book. I always say that, you know, I know what I'm good at. I'm good at pulling together teams. I'm gonna bring people to the finish line and helping, you know, lead people to a destination. But this book is a team effort from George McCallman, our brilliant art director who, you know, did the cover and all the visuals, to, you know, the many visual artists that I commissioned to do the pieces, to everyone who contributed. And it's just moving. And I think people understood that this was bigger than all of us, you know?
I want to go back to something you just said, Brian, about commissioning the art, because I mean, you know, it's beautiful. I mean, it's just gorgeous. Every time I walk past like a cafe that has this cover, I stop and take a picture. Like, oh, Black Food is out in the world. But I want to talk a little bit about the art that you commissioned, because this is really special what you did with the recipes and these pieces that we don't always see. You know, in a cookbook, you see the recipe, you see the dish, you see the final dish, but you're seeing so much more than that. You're seeing this intention and thought and ideas sort of convening in a piece of artwork, mm-hmm. and then the food is a piece of artwork as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll say this. In terms of the structure of this book, I often talk about one of my favorite filmmakers is Spike Lee, and I often talk about how, you know, his body of work, when you think about, like, She's Gotta Have It and School Days and Do the Right Thing, I always say that those films prepared him to make the masterpiece that is Malcolm X. Mm. And I feel like my whole body of work before this allowed me to practice to bring this book to life, because I've been doing this, like, you know, with my first book, Grub, which I co-authored with Anna LaPan in 2006, I commissioned a visual artist, Tenjin Nikita, this New York-based lentil-cut artist, to do four lentil cuts that represented each season. And then there were seasonal menus, and we had the, like, heady intellectual information and the action steps, and then we had the recipes. So I feel like that's been kind of the blueprint that I've been working with since the beginning. But I just want to talk about, like, because this cover is art. Like, this, for me, I can I say this about my own book that I
yes,
brought
you,
to light?
Yes,
like, this is the most awesome cover that I've seen in a long
speak
time.
Speak on it.
but I want to talk about this, because I don't talk about this a lot, but the art was just so important in this book. And even, you know, we were just, this piece right here. So this had actually... This was going to be the cover. And we had talked about wanting to kind of play off a European still life. And we were like, we're going to do some Afro still life. And we were towards the end of production of the book. And so one of the signatures of my work is doing a suggested soundtrack with every recipe. And this book has, like, a full-on playlist. And so I had actually been working on a playlist on Spotify, and I was sending it out to some friends and colleagues, Nicole Taylor, Hawa Hassan, some other folks. And I was just like, listen to the playlist. I just want you to take the weekend, listen to it, give me your feedback, and I'll make some changes based on that or not. And so Nicole Taylor, mm-hmm. she hit me up, and she was like, look, I love the playlist, and I feel like it speaks to people of our generation. Yeah. But I don't feel like there's something in there for my 20-year-old assistant. I don't feel like she'd look at that playlist and feel like she can connect with it. There's not a lot of contemporary music, younger artists. So I just went on this journey of, like, researching younger artists and what the music is now. And honestly, after that process, it made me reevaluate this as a cover. And I really started to understand that it was actually just very academic. You know, it was like this visual thesis mm-hmm. statement. And I just realized I didn't need to do that. You know, I don't have to, like, explain everything on the cover. And when George McCallum and I first met to talk about the book, that evening, he did this mock-up. He, like, literally was like, boom, 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 and sent me, like, a little snap of it. It's like, this could be a cover. And then after we had that conversation, or after I decided that the interior image wasn't a cover, we went back to this. And then this is the cover that came from it. And I just wanted something that, you know, people would look across the room, young people, old people in a bookstore, in a library, and just be like, what is that? Like, I just need to at least go take a look and see what's happening inside.
It's a stopping point. I mean, it is really beautiful and arresting. So congratulations on having something that really, I mean, that's how, you know, when in this world, a social media world, where, like, all of our attention span is so quick, and then have this thing that you just want to stop and look at and absorb and ingest. You can feel that intentionality, and you can feel that beauty, so that when you dive into every piece of art that's within the book, you are feeling, you're having a whole new experience. And I think it's really interesting that you talked about this, like, you had the blueprint, and you had this evolution of from your first book in through Vegetable Kingdom, through Black Food. But now you don't have to explain yourself anymore. You can just go and do, like, yes, this is the cover, and you can have that solid idea of what you want to do with your work. But now, you know, my question is always, okay, you have something that's successful. What comes after that? And you're doing the thing that's after that, and that's creating this imprint for Color Books to help to create some more babies. Yeah. But for other authors, can you talk about your imprint and what you're doing there?
I'm going to talk about the imprint and just this whole mission and desire to support budding authors and, you know, cookbook authors who I think deserve a voice and a platform. I don't think I've talked about this publicly, but I'm going to say this on stage because I feel comfortable with Jamila and I feel comfortable with you all. This is off the record, though. So, you know, Chris Rock has this bit where he talks about being Chris Rock, the world famous multimillionaire rock star comedian who lives in one of the wealthiest suburbs of New Jersey, and his neighbor, this white guy, is just a regular dentist, right? And I'm gonna be really honest, part of getting this imprint was about me getting more power to have to make unilateral decisions about my own work,
speak
to be
on,
able to just say, like,
this
is, I mean, you know, it's always, I mean, and I will say with each successive book, I've gotten more leeway and more power and more ability to make those decisions. But I just want to have a vision for a project and then just, like, implement that vision. You know, I feel like, and no shade to any of the authors, I know oftentimes it's bigger than them, but I feel like the cookbook field in America, the U.S., is very just stale, redundant. I feel like there's just not a lot of creativity that I like to see. And for our new book, so I've been publicly saying that I'm not, this is my last book. It's not. It's just kind of a marketing thing I'm doing. But anyway, but we're already thinking about a next book project, and we're putting together a whole London-based team. There's a art director and a visual or food stylist that I love her work, and I want her to do my next book. And we're meeting my creative director, Amanda Yee, who lives in Berlin. We're going to be going to London next month, and we're meeting with her, and we're meeting with photographers, because I feel like some of the more exciting cookbooks are coming out of the UK.
They're coming out of the UK, Portugal.
Yeah.
They're way more interesting. You may or may not know this. Oh, I have a quirk. I don't eat leftovers. I don't like food the next day. And some of the cookbook, it feels like leftovers. It feels like, I had that lasagna when it was smoking hot and the cheese was, like, all curdled, and you're giving me the stuff the next day when it doesn't taste as good. And that's so, but then I go to the UK or I go to Berlin and I see these really beautiful, innovative, smart books from all kinds of people, stuff that makes me want to dive in. And I don't see that from the U.S. I see something that could have been 5 years ago, 10 years ago, yesterday's food. Mm-hmm. And that's what's so special about this book. Mm-hmm. And I think what you're trying to do is, like, I'm trying to give you something new. And the publishing industry kind of works off of what they already know. In newspapers, we have to give you the news. We have to give you something new every day. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to give you yesterday's story unless something has changed. And that, I think, sounds so much of what you're trying to do. I'm trying to give you something new, innovative, smart, immersive art. Like, I keep saying, like, Black food is art. Black food is a diaspora. Black food is perspective. Mm-hmm. And you're trying to do something that's not leftovers.
And you know, I was focusing on the visuals, but as you mentioned, even with the content, I want people in America, this cookbook industry here, And at large, but just to reimagine what cookbooks can look like. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to just be like recipes and then head notes and then the photographs. You know, mm-hmm. We can infuse it with the art and the culture and the history and the memory and all the things that I think are just the things that make us human. The things that really
make us human.
Yeah, but you know, just really quickly to your point, it's exciting to me. And I always say that, you know, as a publisher, the work that I'm doing with this imprint is formalizing what I've been doing for years. You know, I had the pleasure when my first book came out with my co-author, Anna LaPay. It was the 40th anniversary of her mother's book, Diet for a Small Planet. I'm sure some of you have heard of that seminal book that came out in the 70s. And we got a chance to go on tour with her. And it was just so powerful being with this elder, this woman who was mentoring us and just showing us how this game works, showing us about being prepared for interviews and being professional and dealing with, you know, the fans and audiences. And I vowed from that moment that I was going to pay it forward. Mm-hmm. And I was like, you know, I'm going to always support budding authors and, you know, mentor people. And so now I have the ability to have power to actually give people, you know, book deals and help them actually, you know, take their careers to the next level.
Power is everything. You know, leadership is one thing, but power. So you're doing both. You have leadership and power.
And I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, because when Korsha and I were talking, we talked about
this. Korsha Wilson, who's another food writer, and Nicole Taylor is another food writer you mentioned, and she has a book, and I'm not going to remember that. It's Watermelon and Red Drinks. Oh, I remember the name. Watermelon and Red Drinks. It's a book about Juneteenth that's coming out in May.
Yeah.
And then Korsha Wilson is working on a couple of books with Chef Eric Ajapong. So for your book buying list.
Yeah, for sure. I'm so excited about both of those. But, so we were talking about the fact that, you know, in 2020, a lot of the publishers, they were just... This was a moment where they were like, okay, we got to fix this. So they were giving a lot of Black creatives book deals, and people were getting like good book deals, like big advances, the type of things that, you know, I would
argue.
We use
some real hard numbers, like.
I mean, people were getting like big six, like high six figure numbers.
Yeah, like $250,000 advances, $300,000 advances, in an industry where the average may have been more like $75,000 to write the book, and you have to pay to produce your book for that for that fee.
And these were first time authors, you know, maybe more seasoned authors might get that, but I guess the point is that I was very clear, because, you know, I am a historian, I've seen it before, and I was like, you know what? This moment's gonna end. Like, they're gonna feel like they've done whatever to absolve themselves, and then the door's gonna close. And I was saying to Korsha, you know, I feel like the door is closing. And then Korsha actually responded, I think it's closed. And she was even saying that her, you know, as a respected seasoned journalist, she feels like the jobs that she's getting are kind of, you know, dying down to a trickle.
I think the door's closed. I think the door closed last year. And especially if you don't have a book idea that fits the mold or fits that, I mean, if you don't have a struggle story, if you don't have like, you know, sort of our struggle is entertainment in a lot of ways. And so if you just have a book about joy, that door is closed. And I think it's because it's hard for in an industry that doesn't have a relationship with all kinds of Black people, it's really hard for them to imagine just a book about Black girl in Paris.
Right.
It's really I think that's a real challenge for the industry, but I think that's why I'm so fortunate, or I'm so thankful for you and your work and what you're going to continue to do and what you're going to be continuing to bring new authors to us so we can share them more broadly, because change is a process, not an event. And you're part of the process, and you're at the point where you can make that happen for so many people. So I'm thankful for that.
Thank you. I'm glad you mentioned that point really quickly about just to kind of what Amanda and I often talk about is, what do we say, trauma porn.
Trauma porn.
And how we don't get enough books that just allow us to just be human, just be regular, just doing my thing, or just to really celebrate joy. And with this book, you know, I say Toni Morrison is the godmother of this book project, because her Black book that she produced in the 1970s, she edited this collection that really was just looking at Black life from, I think, the 1600s to the mid-20th century. And she brought together, you know, essays and archival photos and song lyrics and ephemera. And that spirit really inspired this. But when I emailed the potential contributors, I sent an email. I wish I had it, but I said something to the extent of what I had been meditating on thinking about this book was Toni Morrison's quote where she asks us, you know, what do our lives look like without racism? Mm-hmm. When we don't have this albatross of white supremacy around our necks, you know, what are our joys? What are our you know, where's our magic? What's the agency we bring to our lives? And I let everyone know that that's what I wanted the spirit of this book to be. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't talk about our history, our food history, without talking about marginalization and oppression and erasure. All those things are a reality. And I didn't want to focus on that because we've seen and heard this story so many times. And I did want this to be something that, you know, really brought people a sense of just excitement and joy and left them feeling good and not hopeless and depressed after they left the book.
So. It's a real work of beauty. Thank you, Bryant.
Thank you.
We have time for a couple questions.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, so even today I was walking in the library and I was going to do my thing. I saw the book cover and I just stopped and I was like, I have to know more about what's going
on. See, it worked.
It did. It's so beautiful. It's breathtaking. So my question is, I have a Ashanti background. Like, I'm from Ghana, West Africa, and I was just there a couple months ago. And one thing I noticed was that for us, cooking, it's not an individual thing. Like, it's not like a Betty Crocker. You're in the kitchen alone. You know, it's your sisters, your aunts, your uncles, you know, getting the crops and the animals and everything. So I was really curious, just how do you, and you were talking about community, you know, with your work in the museum, how do you kind of capture that sense of community that, you know, doesn't really kind of translate on a page, right? Mm-hmm. How do you go into that and kind of think of ways to let people know that food is about, you know, family and love? It's not just, you know, what you eat on a plate. Like, it's so much more than that.
Great question.
You know, I don't know if you're familiar with my work, but in terms of my larger body of work, cookbook writing is part and parcel of this larger project of, I mean, I think, you know, this is kind of reducing it, reductive in a sense, but just creating a more just and sustainable food system for everyone, one that works for regular everyday folks, regardless of income, zip code, skin color, and not just for the handful of multinational corporations that largely control our food system. And so I talk about that a lot, and I do a lot of community events and work at the museum that's really aimed at inspiring that type of movement building, because I would argue, and you know, we have to be building a strong movement in order to achieve this food justice, right? Because the thing is, you know, we talk about, like, when we talk about, you know, people talk about the food movement, and I think when they hear that, they talk about, they're thinking about this kind of push towards eating more local and seasonal, sustainable food. And oftentimes that doesn't attend to the reality that so many communities deal with, where they have these physical and geographic and economic barriers to accessing healthy, fresh, affordable, and culturally appropriate food. And I always argue that, like, you know, food justice moves beyond advocacy and direct service and calls for organized responses that are owned and driven by the people who are most impacted by food apartheid or food insecurity, right? And so part of that is really helping people to get past these kind of capitalist notions that everything needs to be done individually. Like, I need to fix this problem on my own. And I always say that, you know, even when we're talking about transforming communities, we have to do it communally. We have to do it with each other, you know? And I think about, I mean, I always talk about faith institutions as an example, right? So imagine, no, we're going to talk about, that's a whole other thing. But just, you know, okay, so when I even talk about eating healthfully or eating local seasonally sustainably or eating more of a plant-centered diet, the kind of knee-jerk response that I often hear is, well, it's too expensive. You can't do that. You gotta. And what people are often thinking about is going and spending their money at some corporate-owned supermarket where you spend your whole paycheck to get food. What I encourage people to understand is that, like, I use this example. So, yeah, if you go to Whole Foods, it's expensive because they're selling you a lot of, first of all, they're selling you a lot of crap that's marketed as vegan or you know, gluten-free and all these like terms that really don't even have a legal definition often. They're just marketing terms. But imagine if you and I, you know, went, Jamila, you, like, Anyabuele, and we went to the farmer's market, we pooled our money together, we're able to support local farmers and, you know, helping the local economy. We're getting all this fresh, organic, seasonal produce that is nutrient-dense and delicious. And then we're not having to spend all of our individual money. We're doing it collectively. And then we go back to Jamila's fabulous house with the big chef's kitchen. And she has all the equipment that we need. And then we're making a diversity of dishes that are home cooked that we can divvy among each other. You can freeze some things. I make a soup. You know, Jamila makes a stew. You make a big vat or whatever. And then we're also building community. We're connecting with people that we know. We're exchanging. We're having this opportunity to know each other. And I think that's the solution. We have to, like, for, especially for historically marginalized communities, I think it really has to be one in which we are building with each other, where self-determination is at the fore. And we're, I mean, I think a lot of people are feeling like this, but I think one thing, the past 2 years, what we've seen, the inept response to this public health crisis from our government, the kind of like widening of the wealth gap, you know, the further concentration of wealth in the hands of elites. I think a lot of people are just feeling like this isn't working. This economic system is broken, and it's certainly not working for the people at the bottom. And a lot of people are thinking about ways of creating alternatives outside of capitalism. And I think that there can be ways in which, you know, we all are participating in one way or another, even if we don't want to. But then we have to be thinking about how can we care for our communities? How can we assure that we're all okay? And I think those type of kind of communal traditions that we see in traditional societies on the continent and other indigenous communities, we need to be studying them. We need to be thinking about why they worked, how they worked, and looking at those best practices. And, you know, just this whole idea of Sankofa, where we're looking back and then bringing with us the traditions and best practices and the things that our ancestors knew worked, and then bringing them forward with us. So I totally agree with you. And I hope that this book further just encourages people, because ultimately I don't want people at their home. You know, the beautiful thing about this book is that it's everything. You know, it could sit on your coffee table. It's an art book. It can be on your bedstand and something you read at night. It could be in the kitchen. But I want people experiencing and enjoying this in community, and not just alone, or not just with their nuclear family. So
that's beautiful. Other questions? Well, I want to ask you about, you know, a lot of the recipes in this book, and of course, Vegetable Kingdom, Afro Vegan, and our plant. I like to say plant forward.
I like that.
Because I think that you can have a plant-centered diet without being a vegan or a vegetarian. I'm not a vegan or a vegetarian, but I don't cook meat at home, just because it's because I don't eat leftovers. But I wanted you to talk about something you just said about sort of going back to the ancestors and understanding foodways and food systems. Can you kind of talk about sort of your philosophy around having, you know, a lot of plant-centered, plant-forward recipes in this book, and your entire oeuvre around, you know, that kind of way of eating?
First of all, I want to say that one of the early moments of, how can I put it? I guess it was, there was a period where I was struggling with whether I wanted this to be an all plant-based book mm-hmm. or not early on. And it was for a couple reasons. Like I don't think that a vegan diet is the perfect diet for everyone. Now, like in terms of health and well-being, I can make arguments all day around the economic, the environmental, certainly the ethical reasons why we should all be vegans. But in terms of health and well-being, there is no perfect diet. We all have different bodily constitutions, health ways, age, health status, cultural foods that I think should play into what we're eating. But, you know, I was really concerned that a lot of my fans, a lot of my long time base would be disappointed mm-hmm. and that I would lose them. Because I don't know if you can know, a lot of vegans can be very dogmatic. and I just felt like their grandma would be like, you put meat in this book, we're done. And maybe some of them did. I'm sure some of them did do that. But I think this was a moment where I had to take off the hat, my Bryant Terry, the personal approach and like author hat, and put on my editor hat and do what was best in service of this book project. Mm-hmm. And I knew that giving the creatives, the chefs, the people who contributed to it, the space to tell them their most authentic food stories was more important than this dogmatism about like having it just be a vegan book. And I'm glad I did that, because it really allowed people just to, like, you know, Hawa Hassan, who offered the Somali lamb stew, this is an important dish in her culture, in her family, and she wanted to write about that. And I think it was important that she do that. And I part of this project, I was telling Jamila that I'm going to be a visiting scholar and resident artist at the African American Studies Department at UC Berkeley for the next academic year. And part of my project is going to be building on this, what I often talk about is this thread of Black-led food and health activism throughout the 20th century. So we could talk about like the traditional diets in many Western Central African cultures that were largely vegetable-based, whether they were like vegan or not, I don't know, it's questionable. But like there are these traditions, and even if you look at what is often the most vilified cuisine, African-American cuisine, you know, because people have this reductive way of thinking about it, when you think about the kind of diversity and complexity of that cuisine, it's largely vegetable-based, you know, especially before the industrialization of our food system. And so we need to take all that into account, but I also just want people to know that there, Black folks have been active food justice activists. We could talk about like the theologically driven activism. I mean, look, the first time I even heard about this idea of vegetarian or veganism as a young person, we're from Black Seventh-day Adventists in our community. And then, you know, when I did my obligatory, like kind of obsessive moment about the Nation of Islam after reading the autobiography of Malcolm X, you know, learning about like Honorable Elijah Muhammad and his health ministry with How to Eat to Live, Volume 1 and Volume 2. We could talk about Rastafarians and their Ital diet. And so I just think that the way in which in the popular imagination, people often see vegetarian or veganism as, you know, historically like this kind of suburban, upper middle class white practices, and more recently, the practices of, you know, young white gentrifiers in urban centers. And you know, I have to remind people that these are practices that our communities have had. You know, we've had institutions and restaurants and people who have been uplifting this as a way to eat and really rejecting the standard American diet. And so this idea that Black people need to, I mean, yes, we're dealing with the public health crisis and the exponential rise over the past several decades in preventable diet-related illnesses. And I argue that we needn't look any further than our own cultural foods. You know, I talk about Black superfoods, and I know that's a marketing term that are used to just sell things like, oh, quinoa, magical food from the Andes, or acai, or whatever. But, you know, you think about something like collards that are high in vitamin A and C and E and are proven to have these cancer-fighting compounds. Like, we have so many of our foods, from like fonio, this grain in West Africa, to, I mean, the list goes on. And so, you know, whether it's a strict vegan diet we could talk about that. But like this idea of eating a lot of vegetables, that's a part of who we are. We come from agrarian roots. We have been growing food and eating in this way. And I just want people to remember, piece back these histories, and know that that is a path towards our health liberation.
Yeah, I think that's beautiful, because we really do have the power. I mean, when we think about, you know, ways to eat, climate, food insecurity, the people who are going to be most impacted are the people who have actually given us the blueprint, back to what you were saying earlier, of how to eat to live, mm-hmm. how to have more health and well-being by following the diets that we were left with.
Yes.
And so it's really a matter, and I think that's something that you do, that you weave in really beautifully, because yes, I want to eat the lamb stew. Hawa Hassan also has a really wonderful book called In Bibi's Kitchen. It's another really wonderful thing to add to your list. So I want to eat Hawa Hassan's lamb, but I also want to eat vegetables. I want to know that history. And the more we have a better understanding of our food, we have a better understanding of culture. I mean, that's something we talk about a lot at the Philadelphia Inquirer, is how are we writing about are we writing about food or are we writing about culture? If you're not writing about culture, you're not writing about food. So is that a Philadelphia Inquirer food story? So how we bring that in really follows that blueprint that you've left for us about thinking about how to take some of these things forward. Well,
can I quickly just talk about some of the books that we're publishing?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, so I just wanted to just tell you a little bit about Four Color, my imprint. At this point, this is a flagship publication, Black Food, which is published in October. And we're taking this year largely to focus on just looking inward, really determining what our values are, how we want to show up in the world, and how we want to make an impact. And next year, we'll be publishing two books. We acquired the first book project by this young chef in Oakland, Rahana Bizaret Martinez. She was a runner-up on Top Chef Junior when she was 13 years old. Absolutely brilliant young woman. Absolutely brilliant. Has worked at, you know, she's actually working full-time at Chez Panisse now, the famed restaurant in Berkeley. She's staged at, you know, she cooked at the James Beard House and has worked at Ecoy in London. So we're doing her book, Flavor Us, which is really about community and food. We're the second book we acquired is actually this book by a photographer. So to be clear, because books, cookbooks and food books are my wheelhouse, that will be like our foundation, but we'll be publishing books on everything I'm interested in, from poetry to art to prescriptive nonfiction. And so we acquired an art book. So the second book we're doing is this art book by this Brooklyn-based photographer, Adrian Baril. Mm. And when he was at Austin, UT Austin as a student, he was really just taken aback by when he just the reality of the paucity of Black men on campus hit him. I think it was a 1.7% of the
student population
were Black men. And so he did this whole photographic project where he did portraits of the Black students on campus and did interviews with them, and they got in galleries, and the New York Times did all these pieces and other magazines. And so we acquired this book, and it's called Black Yearbook, and it's building on this first project where he's in the fall did a tour and traveled to educational institutions around North America, from Ivy League to trade schools, and talked to students and, you know, provost and other staff at these institutions and photographed them and then interviewed them and really just got a sense of what the state of being, you know, in the 21st century, what does it mean to be Black in these educational institutions? So excited about that book. It's just, it's woo. He read the intro to our team and we were crying. It would just hit all the right notes. And then we're publishing the book by Scar Pimento. Scar's Pizzeria is one of the most popular pizzerias in New York on the Lower East Side. And then we're doing a book, Memory of Taste, by this author, David Tu Phu, this Vietnamese chef in Oakland, who has this brilliant, I mean, he has a great refugee story coming from Vietnam, and he's photogenic and telegenic. He's on Top Chef. And so I'm really proud of what we have built so far and just see, you know, nowhere but up from here.
You're paying it for it. You're convening. You've got the blueprint. It's just such a joy to talk to you. I can sit here and talk to you all day. Author, chef, scholar, James Beard Award winner, Bryant Terry, everybody.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.